In order to prepare for our studies this morning, we'll pause for a few moments of silent prayer. You may use that time for rebound if necessary. Shall we pray? Father, we are grateful to you for this opportunity to gather here and to study your word. It is our prayer that as we provide the positive volition and concentration, that we'll be encouraged by the things we note today. And we'll lift our prayer in Christ's name. Amen. On the board, you will see the cover of a recent book that was published by Mark Levin. This is Memorial Day, so usually I would have some kind of a message to deliver to the congregation regarding the things that have occurred in our nation's history thanks to the military. But today, I felt like it was out of sync not to recognize what's currently going on in client nation America. And so I have entitled what my comments are today, American Marxism, and therefore what's going on, what the ramifications are with regard to the United States military, which are recruited to guard our shores and to fight our wars. In 2021, Mark Levin continued his production of insight, cogent, and well-researched books, including Liberty and Tyranny, The Liberty Amendments, Unfreedom of the Press, and Men in Black, to name a few. His most recent release is the one we will delve into today, entitled American Marxism. First of all, there is a reason I have chosen not to present an individual or group to honor on this Memorial Day, which has been my practice over the years. However, our client nation, which so many individuals have fought to defend, some of whom gave their ultimate sacrifice of their lives, and now being besmirched by the insidious force within our own borders. I will soon turn 82 years of age. I was born in 1941. Just a few months before the beginning of World War II, when the Imperial Japanese Navy Air Service bombed Pearl Harbor in Honolulu, Hawaii, on Sunday, December 7 of 1941. Prior to this, and beginning with the War for Independence, 1775 to 83, 14 significant engagements occurred. The War of 1812, it raged from 1812 to 15. The War of Texas Independence, 1836. Mexican-American War, 1846 to 48. The War between the States, 1861 to 65. The Spanish-American War, 1898. World War I, 1914 to 18, World War II, 1939 to 45, the Korean War, 1950 to 53, Vietnam War, 1960 to 75, the Persian Gulf, 1990 to 91, Afghanistan, 2001 to 2021, Iraq, 2003 to 11, and Libya, 2015 to 23. In these and other minor conflicts, members of the United States Armed Forces were deployed into harm's way. The present total of those killed in action exceed 2,295,000. In my 38 years here as pastor, we have systematically saluted those who have been deployed into harm's way, those who have been injured in combat, and those killed in action. Presently, we have no significant spots being engaged. At least not those in military uniform. Our armed forces are not literally deployed to hot spots officially, but they are scattered around the world, both in country and beyond. Their jobs were to protect the client nation from foreign predators, and they have successfully done their jobs. Then, in 2020, these soldiers, sailors, pilots, and Marines were stunned to discover that they and their fellow combatants who died to keep this nation free from foreign aggressors were betrayed by their very own fellow citizens. No foreign force advanced upon the nation's shores from afar. Yet, stunningly, the unthinkable occurred. Americans took to the streets and committed the kind of violence these military personnel had fought, bled, and died to prevent from happening in the homeland. Suddenly, without warning, fellow citizens attacked other fellow citizens. Businesses were invaded. Private property was stolen. Employees and owners were attacked. Some were killed. In many cases, the building was burned. Grand theft was commonplace. Lives were lost in the streets. Mayhem was the order of the day, of both the day and the night. The cost of lives, property, and possessions all occurred without any meaningful resistance as the predators got away scot-free, leaving their aftermath the devastation a foreign army would have been pleased to claim. Question arises. In over 2.5 years, the chaos that occurred, the lives that were lost, the property that was stolen, and the devastation left behind can only be explained by sinister wonderment that this nation was attacked while the powers that be turned a blind eye in complicity. There is only one conclusion that one is left to logically consider. Whereas one of the most powerful military organizations in history has been left standing unmoved, while the nation has been ransacked, not by the Chinese, the Russians, or even the invading throngs crossing the southern border, but by our own fellow citizens. Thus, there is only one logical conclusion that can be considered. The United States is presently being overthrown from within. Not by foreign adversary, but by a complicit government in concert with lawless citizens. Therefore, on this Memorial Day of 2023, we meet here to look back on the mayhem that has engulfed this client nation by government focused on overthrowing the government. The end game is the implementation of Marxism in concert with other nations who presently deploy such a system. The people, those who are left alive, will be mollified by a steady diet of bugs while living in dormitories. That's the plan. With the current zeitgeist in mind, I have chosen not to salute the military heroes as we have been the norm to do, but to cite excerpts from Mark Levin's book, American Marxism. This title is an expose of the presently developing agenda by your fellow citizens in power, whose clear focus on your future is fought right out of dark side's strategy. Client Nation America's coup de grace. I'm going to now quote from Mark Levin. You can see in my book here, Little Yellow Things. That's where I'm going to go to read. This is not a bedtime story. Haight America Incorporated is chapter 3. Here are the excerpts that I will pass along to you. And by the way, this book was copyrighted 2 years ago. Many things have occurred since then that give the title here, American Marxism. You would think that I would be quoting about some of the battles and victories that we've enjoyed from our military over almost a quarter century, quarter millennium, I should say. But now is not the day to do that. Our military is under assault from those who are in charge of it. Here's the background. The progressive intellectuals of the late 1800s and early 1900s laid the foundation for the present-day acceptance and indoctrination of the Marxist ideology throughout academia, society, and the culture. They made clear their hostility toward capitalism and the constitutional republican system that established barriers against tyrannies of various kinds, including that which is born from the mob of centralized autocracy and, of course, what would become known as progressivism. They understood that the citizenry generally was not amenable to their alien objectives. Thus, they undertook a long campaign to educate, or better stated, re-educate and indoctrinate future armies of radicals and revolutionaries, such as students and student advocates through government schools and the institutions of higher learning. Thus, there has been an Americanized adaption of Marxism, which uses Marx's core precepts and contextualities contextualizes them to the American system in order to effectively overthrow the system, governmental, economic, social, and cultural. Indeed, the report goes on to say, quote, Marxism and feminism, Marxism and deconstruction, Marxism and race, this is where the exciting debates are, said Jonathan M. Weiner, a professor of history at the University of California at Irvine, end quote. Indeed, in 1989, at the time of the article's publication, the seeds of a radical fringe ideology called critical theory, which I discuss at length in a subsequent chapter, and the unraveling of the existing society by weaponizing the culture against itself, began their early bloom throughout the American landscape, but with little public notice. In fact, Barringer unknowingly exposes what will become a central tenet of critical race theory and other adaptations of Marxism to Americanism, that is, the assault on American history, its institutions and traditions, or, quote, the dominant white culture, end quote, including by her own employer and publisher, the New York Times, in such schemes as the 1619 Project. She wrote, deconstructionists deny that one can understand any experience of the past because the evidence for any conclusion comes from people's observations, most of which appear in a text. Deconstructionists maintain that texts are only stories told by people who leave out what they deem important, and that such omissions keep written history from being reliable evidence about reality. Thus, the war on the traditional teaching of history begins its metastasization throughout academia. In American colleges and universities, there is no limit to how professors can and do use Marxism as a doctrinal tool. Barringer explained, quote, "Diversity is now the signature of once monolithic Marxism." Professor Spivak, who teaches English at the University of Pittsburgh, calls herself a Marxist feminist. Professor John Romer, economics professor at the University of California at Davis, designs Marxist market-driven economics, and Eric Olin Wright, a sociology professor at the University of Wisconsin, calls himself an analytic Marxist, seeking to break Marx's grand theories down into their components. Moreover, the early progressives understood that they must institutionalize their educational activism by, among other things, controlling the administration of education and the classroom through a tenured and unionized legion of teachers, where like-minded instructors armed with ideologically driven curricula populate all levels of educational institutions, often choose their successors, and are protected from scrutiny or competition. For these reasons and more, they adamantly oppose standardized testings, merit-based teacher evaluations, school choice, and the like. After all, their purpose is to uproot traditional, pre-progressive-oriented educational approaches and clear the way for progressive, Marxist-oriented, ideologically-based doctrinal approaches instead. It also bears reminding that the early progressives, like their modern progeny, are the intellectual offspring of Rousseau, Hegel, and Marx. They share the overreaching view that the individual must be subjected to the greater community. Herbert Croly, a leading progressive mastermind and founder of the New Republic, explained in his 1909 book, The Promise of American Life, that, quote, "The better future to which Americans propose to build is nothing if not the idea which must, in certain essential respects, emancipate them from their past. American history contains much matter of pride and congratulation and much matter of regret and humiliation. Americans must be prepared to sacrifice their traditional vision, even the traditional American way of realizing it." Hence, Croly denounces America's past and insists that it not only be rejected, but that the American people learn to reject it. In other words, as Marx preached, the citizenry must condemn and cast off their own history if there is to be individual and societal progress. Of course, this attitude has now taken firm hold throughout academia and has spilled over into much of our culture. Next excerpt. I wanted you to hear this. A name you know, Herbert Marcuse, is credited with hatching the critical theory ideology. As mentioned earlier, he was a German-born Hegelian Marxist ideologue of the Frankfurt School of Political Theories. So Marcuse, of course, goes back to the Frankfurt School in the 1920s, and we've studied him and his acolytes. Now let's find out about critical race theory. This is the new curriculum. In short, critical race theory is an insidious and racist Marxist ideology spreading throughout our culture and society. The Heritage Foundation's Jonathan Butcher and Mark Gonzalez write in their study, quote, "The new intolerance and its grip on America," end quote, that it promotes, among other things. Here's a checklist. First of all, the Marxist analysis of society made up of categories of oppressors and the oppressed. 2, the idea that the oppressed impede revolution when they adhere to the cultural beliefs of their oppressors and must put through re-education sessions. 3, the concomitant need to dismantle all societal norms through relentless criticism. And 4, the replacement of all systems of power and even the descriptions of those systems with a worldview that describes only oppressors and the oppressed. Far from being merely esoteric academic exercises, these philosophies have real-life consequences. George R. Lanon, research professor of public policy and political science at the University of Maryland, describes critical race theory through the writings of, quote, the two best-selling proponents of CRT, Robin DiAngelo and Ibram X. Kendi. Critical race theory begins with a presumption that race is the primary way to identify and analyze people and consequently posits a radical hierarchy that supposedly exists with whites on top and blacks at the bottom. Individual behavior is insignificant because everyone in America functions within a society of systemic racism, structural racism, and institutional racism. Critical race theory affirms this perspective by pointing to various existing racial disparities, which it claims are the result of racist discrimination. According to this perspective, efforts by public and private organizations to enforce civil rights laws is employment, housing, contracting, education, etc., are either insufficient or pointless. Critical race theory offers two responses to this situation. First of all whites must admit their culpability by confessing the advantages white supremacy confers on them. Failure to do so reflects, quote, white fragility and instinctive defensiveness that whites are said to display after they have been trained about their investment in racism. Secondly, individual whites cannot hide behind any personal history of non-discrimination or the desirability of race-neutral laws or policies because the collective action of their race has been oppressive. Now, in acknowledging their white privilege, Lanon explains that whites must support anti-race anti-racist policies that require various forms of race preferences for non-whites across a variety of fields for an indefinite period of time. This is required even where whites are a local minority and power structures are controlled by non-whites or blacks, indigenous, and people of color in the current terminology. Now, in his book, Intellectuals in Society, Dr. Thomas Sowell, author, scholar, and professor, denounces the entire multicultural identity politics movement. He explains that, quote, the kind of collective justice demanded for racial or ethnic groups is often espoused as, quote, social justice, since it seeks to undo disparities created by circumstances, as well as those created by the injustices of human beings. Moreover, cosmic justice not only extends from individuals to groups, it extends beyond contemporary groups to intertemporal abstractions, of which today's groups are conceived as being the current embodiments, end quote from Thomas Sowell. Now, among intellectuals who confuse blame with causation, writes Sowell, the question beginning phrase, blaming the victim, has become a staple in discussions of intergroup differences. No individual or group can be blamed for being born into circumstances, including cultures, that lack the advantages that other people's circumstances have. But neither can society be automatically assumed to be either the cause or the cure for such disparities." End quote. Indeed, critical race theory takes blame to a new and disastrously hateful level. That is, white privilege and white dominant culture are responsible for all manner of black and minority grievances and dissatisfaction. Moreover, the claim is that the existing system has been permanently rigged against blacks and minorities from its founding by white racists. Sowell explains that, quote, "Even if one believes that environment is the key to the intergroup differences, that environment includes a cultural legacy from the past, and the past as much beyond our control as the geographic settings and historic happenstances that have left not only different individuals or races, but whole nations and civilizations with very different heritages." End quote. Now, while Marcuse and his progeny are obsessed with categorizing individuals and treating such groups as stagnant and operating within their own boxes, Sowell contends that such a belief and approach is actually destructive to the very people who are said to be oppressed. In the context of multiculturalism, Sowell argues, quote, "If the dogmas of multiculturalism declare different cultures equally valid and hence sacrosanct against efforts to change them, then these dogmas simply complete the sealing off of a vision from facts and sealing off many people in lagging groups from the advances available from other cultures around them, leaving nothing but an agenda of resentment building and crusades on the side of angels against the forces of evil. However futile or even counterproductive these may turn out to be for those who are the ostensible beneficiaries of such moral melodramas. In fact, critical race theory goes beyond arguing that different cultures are equally valid. It describes that society is a systematically racist, white dominant culture and enlists those who are dissatisfied, disaffected, and malcontented into a growing legion of anti-American revolutionaries where minorities are at dagger points with the white dominant societal forces. In his 1964 book, One Dimensional Man, Marcuse urges the expansion of Marxist ideology and revolution to include racial and ethnic groups. Here's a quote, "Underneath the conservative popular base is the substratum of the outcast and outsiders. The exploited and persecuted of other races and other colors, the unemployed and the unemployable. They exist outside the democratic process. Their life is the most immediate and the most real need for ending intolerable conditions and institutions. Thus, their opposition is revolutionary, even if their consciousness is not. Their opposition hits the system from without and is therefore not deflected by the system. It is an elementary force which violates the rules of the game and in doing so reveals it is a rigged game. When they get together and go out into the streets without arms, without protection, in order to ask for the most primitive civil rights, they know they face dogs, stones, bombs, jail, concentration camps, even death. Their force is beyond every political demonstration for the victims of law and order, the fact which marks the beginning of the end of a period." Well, that was Marcuse. We studied him about 20 years ago. Indeed, Marcuse and other Marxists spawned critical race theory and seemingly endless list of disgruntled, ideologically driven groups. Discrimination is based on race, ethnicity, gender, sexual preference, economics, and a potential myriad of other diverse human characteristics, qualities, preferences, and circumstances. In fact, often individuals and groups are said to be victims of more than one kind of discrimination. For example, if an individual is female, Muslim, and black, she is said to be subjected to multiple forms of discrimination. This, too, has been given a name by, among others, University of California, Los Angeles law professor Kimberly Crenshaw, intersectionality. That's called a combo. In an interview with CNN in 2020, Crenshaw described critical race theory as, quote, a practice. It's an approach to grappling with a history of white supremacy that rejects the belief that what's in the past is in the past and that the laws and systems that grow from that past are detached from it. Critical race theory attends not only to law's transformative role, which is often celebrated, claims Crenshaw. She continues, but also to its role in establishing the very rights and privileges that legal reform was set to dismantle. Like American history itself, a proper understanding of the ground upon which we stand requires a balanced assessment, not a simplistic commitment to jingoistic accounts of our nation's past and current dynamics, end quote. In other words, critical race theory determines and exploits America's unique and very successful fusion of diversity and cultural assimilation and considers all issues in the context of past societal imperfections, regardless of enormous struggles and efforts in creating a more perfect society, including a civil war, massive economic redistribution, and groundbreaking legal changes. Even more, it incorporates and advances an increasing list of causes as new or additional reasons for eradicating society and transforming the country. Indeed, critical race theory repositions what is the most tolerant and beneficent society on earth as a miserably dark and impoverished nation from its beginning all the way to today. Despite Marcuse's call to revolution among minority groups, some Marxist pursuits saw critical race theory as diffusing and undermining Marx's material historicism, that is, the notion of class struggle based on economic conditions. That view has all but passed. Critical race theoreticians are typically Marxist in orientation and mostly consider their theory for transitioning society as blending with the Marxist agenda. For example, for the Marxist and the critical race theoretician, the past is evidence of manipulation, exploitation, mistreatment, and corruption of different classes of people. America is therefore an irredeemably contemptible society that must be relentlessly condemned and ultimately toppled. Like Marx, the critical race theory proponents deal in group stereotypes and prejudices, whether talking about the perpetrators or victims based on race, etc. The assumptions are made about individuals grounded on their physical, religious, ancestral, and other characteristics. But human beings are more than racial beings, just as they are more than economic beings. And the Marxist ideology preaches a monumental and deadly distortion of man's nature. Individuals are complex and complicated, unique and spiritual. They are influenced by innumerable events, circumstances, motivations, desires, interests, etc. It is the Marxist and critical race academics and activists who create these categories for their own convenience and revolutionary purposes. and proposes when demanding the dissolution of society and its rebirth as some utopian autocracy or mobocracy. Of course, this is not to say that individuals and the larger society are unaffected by racial and other such distinctions, but not to the exclusion of and not through the sole lens of a host of other human influences. Among the most widely read books on critical race theory is, unsurprisingly, Critical Race Theory. The authors, Professor Richard Delgado and his wife, Jean, get a load of this. I don't want you to doze off on this one. The authors of Critical Race Theory are Professors Richard Delgado and his wife, Jean Stefancic, both teach law at the University of Alabama. I'm canceling my alumni dues. They write in part, "The critical race theory movement is a collection of activists and scholars engaged in studying and transforming the relationship among race, racism, and power. The movement considers many of the same issues that conventional civil rights and ethnic studies discourses take up, but places them in a broader perspective that includes economics, history, setting, group, and self-interest, and emotions and the unconscious. Unlike traditional civil rights discourse, which stresses incrementalism and step-by-step progress, critical race theory questions the very foundations of the liberal order, including equality theory, legal reasoning, enlightenment rationalism, and neutral principles of constitutional law. After the first decade, critical race theory began to splinter and now includes well-developed Asian American jurisprudence, a forceful Latino critical contingent, feisty LGBT interest groups, and now a Muslim and Arab caucus. Although the groups continue to maintain good relations under the umbrella of critical race theory, each has developed its own body of literature and set of priorities. Thus, like Marx, the critical race theory movement openly disdains and rejects mankind's progress over the centuries, if not several millennia, which serve as the underpinning of American society and other advanced societies, as well as a racial progress in our country, which is diminished as an improvement by, for, and of the white privileged class. By rejecting, quote, equality theory, legal reasoning, enlightenment rationalism, and neutral principles of constitutional law, critical race theory reveals itself as a radical dogma and fanatical cause led by true believers. Delgado and Stefancic break down the meaning and the basis of critical race theory as follows. First, racism is ordinary, not aberrational. Normal science, the usual way society does business, the common everyday experience of most people of color in this country. Hence, racism is rampant, ubiquitous, conscious, and unconscious. It is everywhere, and there's no escaping it. Minorities are relentlessly victimized as individuals and a class, and in all manners by white dominance. And short of eradicating society, there's no cure. That's the mindset, that's the doctrine. Point two. Most would agree that our system of white over color ascendancy serves important purposes, both psychic and material. For the dominant groups, the first feature is that racism is difficult to cure because it is not acknowledged. Colorblind are formal conceptions of equality expressed in rules that insist only on treatment that is the same across the board, can thus remedy only the most blatant forms of discrimination. Therefore, goes the argument, widespread white privilege and white supremacy are a specific scientific fact that must be acknowledged if there is to be any true racial progress. References to and actions based on promoting color blindness or equality are meaningless and superficial diversions away from a real cultural revolution. The second feature, material determinism, adds a further dimension, declared Delgado and Stefancic. This is a quote. Because racism advances the interest of both white elites, that's materially, and working class whites, physicality, large segments of society have little incentive to eradicate it. For our purposes here, Marx's material determinism simply means that individuals and mankind are influenced and motivated by purely material factors. Delgado and Stefancic write that, quote, a third theme is the social construction thesis, which holds that race and races are products of social thought and relations. Not objective, inherent, or fixed, they correspond to no biological or genetic reality. Rather, races are categories that society invents, manipulates, or retires when convenient. People with common origin share certain physical traits, of course, such as skin color, physique, and hair texture, but these constitute only an extremely small portion of their genetic endowment, are dwarfed by what we have in common, and have little or nothing to do with distinctly human, higher-order traits such as personality, intelligence, and moral behavior. If you are somewhat perplexed by this third theme, it is understandable. The critical race theory theoreticians and movement try to advance two conflicting ideas at once. First of all, that minority groups are discriminated against based on their racial, gender, ethnicity, etc. Yet these categories of minority groups are said to have been invented by the unjust society of stereotypical purposes. Actually, it is the critical race theory activist who talk and write about groups and develop new groups of people who are said to be subjected to injustice and discrimination, known and unknown, conscious and unconscious, interminable and everywhere, in a stereotypical fashion, hence identity politics, intersexuality, etc. And of course, Delgado and Stefancic celebrate intersexuality as a key element of the critical race theory movement. That is, discrimination frequently occurs on multiple levels. So they write, quote, closely related to differential racialization, the idea that each race has its own origins and ever-involving history is the notion of intersexuality and anti-essentialism. No person has a single, easily stated, unitary identity. Everyone has potentially conflicting, overlapping identities, loyalties, and allegiances. Clearly, academia is not merely about teaching students how to think, or in the case of Marxism and critical race theory, what to think through repetition and indoctrination, but to develop an army of activist revolutionaries. Delgado and Stefancic write that, unlike some academic disciplines, critical race theory continues an activist dimension. It tries not only to understand our social situation, but to change it, setting out not only to ascertain how society organizes itself along racial lines and hierarchies, but to transform it, quote, for the better. Now, I went through this book I recommend it to you. American Marxism by Mark Levin. And so that's available online or whatever. This is the first section that I wanted to present to you. It is a synopsis of what is going on in Client Nation America. The underlying strategy has to do with the conversion of this country to Marxism, American Marxism. They're underway with this. And I would suggest to you, I believe it to be true, but the reason that the left was so upset about the election and presidency of Donald Trump is that he interrupted this process. It could have been Joe Blow. It wouldn't have mattered. They had everything lined up for Hillary Clinton. She was going to be the lead person. She was going to put it in place. And the whole strategy was based to start about 6 years ago. And they went livid when somehow, some way, what they consider to be a blowhard talked his way into the presidency. And therefore, we had not had that type of freedom, prosperity, and actual laid-back attitudes under that presidency. We can't have that in Marxism. You can't be enjoying things in capitalism. We would not be in charge that way. So everything has been done over the last 2.5 years and will continue to be so to force feed on this population the acceptance of and implementation of Marxism, American Marxism. I've got some other things to read to you. And it's a little bit early, but I want to call it off here because what I'm going to say after we get back from our break will be a summation of the things that we've noted in this first section. Now, I recommend the book to you. You can read the whole thing. Let's see. You know, I always look at the back of a book that I get to see how many pages there are. Something like 278 pages. That's not many. I think you can get it for about 20-something bucks. This is a good place for us to stop. We've got a little extra time here, so let's break. Go get tea and crumpets and come back in about 15 or 20 minutes.